So welcome to today's talk, and I did promise last night to talk about the seven enlightenment factors, but first of all I did promise also I'd read out the quote about the arising and passing away in terms of the Satipatthana, because sometimes it's people don't understand this. So straight from the suttas here, from the Satipatthana Sanghita. And it's called origination. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the origination and the passing away of the four establishments of mindfulness, four satipatthana. Listen to that. And what, monks, is the origination of the body? And it is with the origination of the nutriment, there is the origination of the body. With the cessation of nutriment, there is the passing away of the body. This is the origination passing away. The four nutriments, as I did mention last night, which keep your body going. And this by itself is a very fascinating, even medical insight of the Buddha. You need your food, which is means your toast and your rice and your fish and chips, whatever country you come from. You need your food, your nutrient. But you also need contact as well, which means sensory contact. And I've often thought that if a person was born blind and deaf and they couldn't smell or taste or couldn't feel the body, they would die. You need actually the contact, sensory experience to keep the body going as well. And also volition, will. And many of you know cases where people have given up the will to live and they've died. So you need the will as well to be able to continue. And lastly, consciousness itself keeps the body going. And as people know, when you have a near-death experience and the consciousness flees the body, then the body can't last much longer. So you've got to come back quickly, or that's it. So those are the four nutriments. And, you know, understanding you need sensory experience to keep this body going. You also need will to keep this body going. I know some people have got great wills, very strong wills, and things which would kill normal people, which would actually cause them to die. Because of their strong will, they keep on going. So will is one of the nutriments. You've got food, contact, will, and consciousness. So when they're arising, the body arises and keeps going. But when they cease, then your body is gone. That's what it means in Satipatthana, arising and ceasing, or arising and fading away. And with the origination, this is for feeling. With the origination of contact, there is origination of feeling. The cessation of contact is the passing away of feeling. That's the arising and passing away of Vedana. And you all know that feeling, it's not just the emotional feeling sad, depressed. It's the pleasure and pain which is associated with each one of the six senses. In other words, you need sensory experience first of all. Contact is when you, like the switch contacting the plate to get the electric current going to turn on the lights or the heater or whatever. This is the sensory apparatus turning on. And then once you have sensory apparatus turning on, then you have the pleasure, the pain. So the pleasure and pain is very much everything to do with the sensory apparatus. So once you have senses, you'll have pleasure and you'll have pain. You have to have both. And if you don't have any sensory apparatus, you don't have pain. You don't have pleasure either. So you cannot live in this world with just pleasure. You're going to get pain as well. So if you're having a great time, it's not going to last. If you're having a terrible time, that's not going to last either. It's just all about having senses. And that's an understanding, the arising and passing away of feeling. It's where it comes from, why it comes, why it goes, its causes. And mind, a great thing, with the origination of nama-rupa. And many of you know what nama-rupa is. It's basically, in brief, it's like the objects of consciousness, what you're aware of. And it also includes will and many other things, but it's basically just your, you've got consciousness and you've got nama-rupa. Those two work together. Consciousness is what you're conscious of. So that's nama-rupa gives you arising of consciousness. When nama-rupa finishes, there's nothing to watch, nothing to observe, nothing to feel, then citta, mind, disappears. The arising and passing away of mind. So that's what it means when it says in Satipatthana to notice the arising and passing away of mind. It means understanding not just, you know, it comes and goes, but why it comes and goes. What's its cause? When the cause is taken away, your mind goes. So really, in this retreat, you've come here to lose your mind. And the Dhamma, this is, again, so that sometimes you call that mental objects again, because say with the arising of attention, there's the arising of Dhamma in this fourth Satipatthana. With the cessation of attention, there's the passing away of this Dhamma. So these are things which you pay attention to. You know that when you pay attention to it, it arises. Whether it's contemplating the hindrances or contemplating anicca, dukkha, anatta, when you pay attention to it, then there's that Dhamma arises. You take the attention away and it's gone. So those things aren't always there. Only when you pay attention to them are they there. So that's where you see all those thoughts, those ideas, the stuff, the objects of your mind, they come from attention, and when attention disappears, they disappear. And so I often quote this one over here. It's a very short sutta, but it actually, it complements the Satipatthana, which is spoken of a lot, to give what the Buddha meant by contemplating rising and passing away. That's according to the Buddha. So just to give you a wider understanding, so you understand when people talk about things like Satipatthana, you know exactly what you're supposed to do when it says contemplating rise and fall. And of course, what most people think, it means, oh, seeing these things come into existence, seeing them things go, yeah, they come, they go, they come, they go. But that's not good enough. You want to know why they come, why they go. And to see that causal relationship. And that's the job of the Satipatthana. Okay? It's in there, Satipatthana Sanyutta, called Origins, or Samudaya. But that has now ceased because I'm paying no attention to it anymore. And instead I'm going to pay attention to the seven enlightenment factors, which is describing what it's like to be enlightened. But more importantly, it's describing what you have to do to become enlightened. So do you want to become enlightened? Be careful. Because there are consequences of being enlightened. If you even get to being a non-returner, that means no more sex. It's not a rule, it's just nature, you just can't do it anymore. So when I tell that to people, say, maybe not, maybe I can wait for a while before I become enlightened. Because people have still got their sensory desires, they still want to do things. And it's also when you become fully enlightened, an arahat, that means no more going back home. You have to become a monk or a nun. There's no other choice. It's not as if it's imposed on outside by some sort of law. It's just from inside. It's a natural phenomenon. Basically, if you become enlightened, you just don't fit anymore. You don't fit into the world. You just don't belong there anymore. So you just become a monk or a nun. Obvious. So, do you want to become enlightened? But those who are interested anyway, this is one of the ways you become enlightened. Obviously the standard way you become enlightened is Eightfold Path. Okay, now I always keep on reminding people of that because it's obvious, it's standard, and sometimes it is talked about so much the monks might me don't even bother mentioning it because so many other monks talk about it, and it's such a well-worn track, the Eightfold Path, that sometimes we don't give it the prominence it deserves. It's the way to become enlightened. But there are other explanations of that path. We have the gradual path, which is, maybe I might talk about that later on, but let's see what happens. But another explanation of the way to become enlightened is the seven enlightenment factors, which is the subject of the talk today. And in brief, those enlightenment factors are, number one, mindfulness. And if you think you know what mindfulness is, think again, because I'm going to totally show you a different way of understanding mindfulness. Number two, it is investigating Dhamma. And if people think that thinking and reading and talking about these things and discussing, again, I'm going to show you a different way of what investigating Dhamma is. Otherwise, it's a waste of time coming to these talks. If I'm going to teach you what you already know, what's the point? If I do that, then people fall asleep, which they might do anyway, but I don't know. That's investigating Dhamma. And the next one is energy. And again, I'm going to give you another slant on energy, because sometimes it's the wrong type of energy which we use, which is like striving and trying to get something, and that's not the energy of the enlightenment factors. And the next one is the beautiful pity, the joy. And that's something which I focus on a lot, simply because there are too many miserable meditation retreats where everybody is not supposed to smile. That's when I first became a monk, and you went to... I didn't... No, not first became a monk, sorry. When I first became a Buddhist, you know, I read my books, you know, Four Noble Truths, Suffering. And when I first saw my monks, and you know, the first monks I saw them smiling, I thought, you can't understand Buddhism. It's about suffering. If you were a real monk, you know, you'd be suffering. Understand it, just like... And of course, that was totally wrong. You understand that, no, that pity and joy is an important part of the path. It's like a great revelation as a monk, especially to know this is a joyful path, it's a happy path. And to see all the really great monks and nuns which I've known, all really happy people, they're great to be around. That's what we mean by, like, the joy. That's also why... After the chanting, you know, the three, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now, I don't do that just to be popular. There's a reason behind what I do. That's just to create pity, to create some joy inside of you. So you don't just go around like depressed zombies in this retreat. You know, there's some smile on your face, there's joy, there's some energy, there's happiness coming up. And that's part of the enlightenment factors. It's the path, and it's also... what an enlightened person is supposed to have. They're supposed to be happy people. They've got pity. And that pity, if you see a miserable monk or a nun, they say they're enlightened, and they shout at you for questioning them, they can't be enlightened. They have to be happy people. Pity. But also the passati, this beautiful tranquility of the body and the mind. And that's also something which we recognize, you know, as a quality of somebody who's either enlightened, sometimes a quality in you which you recognize as very, very delightful. It literally is just a different level of happiness, of tranquility. But it's hard to notice that tranquility in others, because sometimes that tranquility can be coming from control. Just like those... what is it, those household guards you can see outside of Buckingham Palace. Totally still, but that's totally out of, you know, totally from control. They're not standing in samadhi. They're just totally controlling themselves. They're military. And the next one is iti pasati. Is samadhi, is the stillness. And that's obviously what we focus on in meditation retreats, because of all the factors, that one is the central one which we try and develop, the stillness. But I'm going to show that that stillness depends upon all the previous factors as well. And lastly, upekkha. Sometimes people call it equanimity, but it literally means being able just to look on without interfering. So be able to look on this happiness and suffering, getting what you want sometimes, not getting what you want sometimes, with all of the ups and downs of life, to be able just to look on and just say, such is life, without getting upset, without getting involved. In other words, the ability to observe, to hear, to know, without interfering. It's a beautiful sense of equanimity. Being apart from the world, being able to look in, to engage when you want to, but to stand back when you need to. Upekkha. So that's it in brief. Now let's get started with mindfulness. And I remember as a young Buddhist, and everyone, we were always supposed to be mindful. So I was just so scared that if I would be unmindful, I was just so on edge. It was like tiptoeing over broken glass. And I thought that was mindfulness. But that wasn't mindfulness, that was fear. Fear of being told off by somebody. And of course, that's not real mindfulness. That's not what mindfulness means by Buddha. It's not some result of, you know, you being a control freak, always being looking over your back and wondering what's going to happen next. You know, it'd be very easy. One of the most mindful mornings I ever had as a young monk was when I woke up in the morning about, you know, just about 3:15, because I felt there was something crawling on my chest. And I looked up and it was a centipede. Now in Thailand, centipedes, if they bite you, they hurt more than snakes. I remember, somebody you may know, that monk, Christopher Titmus, he used to be a monk, now he's a quite a well-known teacher. He told me that he was bitten by a centipede once. He admitted himself to hospital. He said that was the most painful night of his whole life. Sheer agony. And the time, centipedes, we've got centipedes here in our monastery, even here, but they're Buddhist centipedes. They're very nice, they're well trained. They don't go for you. But you know, the ones in Thailand, you know, they're very dangerous. And they're aggressive, they just bite. And so there, and I sort of picked up my flashlight and looked, and there you could see it across my chest. Uh-oh. Now a big one. That's really going to hurt. Especially in this region, the chest. So very carefully got up and I took off my under vest and I looked again. It wasn't there. It was actually, as I took off the vest, it actually crawled onto the vest and that way I got it off my chest. But that morning, I was fully awake. My mindfulness was so acute because I came very close to being in agony for, you know, quite a number of hours and I just managed to escape from that. So I know that, yeah, fear does make you acutely aware, but that's not a very nice mindfulness at all. There's another type of mindfulness which we develop here, and I was mentioning yesterday, through stillness, through starving the energy into the doer, it all goes into the knower. And that's what mindfulness means, like a very powerful knowing. So don't try and make mindfulness happen, because that's a forced type of mindfulness. We let mindfulness happen. There's a great difference. We don't make it happen, we let it happen. So we stop struggling and striving and having all these ideas and fighting and battling our mind and battling everybody else, complaining when someone's alarm clock goes off, complaining when somebody bangs the door and coughs and all that sort of stuff. You're wasting mindfulness. You're wasting your energy. Because no one's going to change. You know that. Doesn't matter how many times I tell them. No matter how many times you tell them. They're not going to change. So you're complete wasting all of your energy. I know I told them the last retreat, you know, people, you know, were thinking, now can't we get this retreat center so good? Can't we make it better? And how can we make it better? We can have like security guards. When anybody coughs, they're thrown out of the retreat. They have health check first of all, and any sign of any irritation in their throat, they're not allowed in. You have your personal climate control just above you, so you can get it just warm, just not too noisy, not too soft. Also, people saying menu for lunch. And also room service. So the point is, even if you did all of that, still people would complain. It would be not good enough. So just complaining is just ruining the mindfulness as you try and plan and scheme and waste all your mental energy and doing things. It's a waste of time. Instead, just be as inactive as you possibly can and as passive as you possibly can. And that way you're not wasting your energy into doing things, into controlling, into scheming and planning. So you'll find naturally the energy flows into your mindfulness and your mindfulness wakes up. You become more aware. I have heaps of stories about how awareness grows in this retreat. Even in the last retreat, just a week ago, people started telling me, yeah, they walked out and actually the forest started to look really beautiful. The leaves were incredibly green. That's a sign your mindfulness is growing. Everything becomes bright and beautiful because you are waking up. Just like you've been driving in a car and the windscreen's all dirty and spattered with bugs and then you clean it all off and it's no dirt at all, then you can see so clearly and you realise, no, the sky isn't grey. It was just your windscreen, that's all. And that's pretty much what happens. In my first meditation retreat, we used to go on a walk every morning for exercise before breakfast. And this was at Cambridge, where I was a student. We hired these boarding houses. And I would go to the Botanic Gardens. It's amazing, the memory of that retreat. It was such a lovely retreat in Bateman Road in Cambridge. And it was just around the corner was the Botanic Gardens. So, of course, you know, being a local, being a student there, I went straight for those Botanic Gardens for my walk. I never got a walk. Because just at the entrance was this clump of bamboo. And even the first day my meditation was good. And I saw that clump of bamboo. Oh my God, that was beautiful. I mean, it really was stunning. And I just couldn't move past it. And there was a bench next to it, you know, the old park bench. So I just sat down there and I just stared at this clump of bamboo for about 50 minutes before, you know, my tummy told me it was time to go to breakfast. And it was incredibly beautiful. You know that bamboo is beautiful because they use it in Chinese watercolours. You know, every Chinese watercolour landscape always had this bamboo because, you know, it's slender and it curves almost, you know, sensually. And even just the leaves and everything about it is incredibly beautiful. And this was the most beautiful bamboo I'd ever seen. Next morning, I went back there, spent another 50 minutes just staring at this beautiful clump of bamboo. That was for 9 days. One day I really needed some exercise, so I went a walk by the river. But 8 of those 9 days, I just went to my clump of bamboo and just stared at it. It was incredibly beautiful. The retreat finished, went back to studies, you know, partying and all that sort of stuff which a student did. And then one day I had a free afternoon and I thought, I had to go and see that clump of bamboo again. It's an incredibly beautiful clump of bamboo. So I got on my bicycle, as you did in Cambridge, you know, weaving in and out of the traffic, taking risks, and eventually finding the botanical gardens, getting off my bike, and looked, I was just really anticipating this incredibly beautiful clump of bamboo, like I remember from the retreat. I'd never seen such a desiccated, weedy, dusty piece of bamboo in my whole life. It didn't fit in London, in England. This was like a tropical tree. It was in the wrong climate. And it really looked like it was in the wrong climate as well. And I just was stunned. Hey, where was all that beauty which I saw just a few days ago? I just couldn't see it anymore. My mind had closed. The mindfulness wasn't there anymore. So I just could not appreciate it. And that was actually a very strong experience of what happens when mindfulness gets very strong. Everything becomes beautiful and lovely. And I can't help telling the story which happened a couple of years ago, which I tell on every retreat, and I told this just 10 days ago for the Singaporean retreat. Everything looks incredibly beautiful, and it just happened that one day, just after lunch, I happened to go to the toilet, and just before flushing, I just happened to look in the bowl. I've never seen such a beautiful piece of shit in my life. The browns and the way they glisten. And the little balls, the way they're stuck together. I mean, that was like a work of art. That's like a put together by a Picasso or something. And the different sort of shades of brown on that turd was like something to behold. I stared in amazement at that piece of feces and just wondering, wow, I can't just flush it away. I must take it back to my room and show others. I love telling that story. It's totally gross. But it was actually true. You know, that's what you felt like. I didn't take it back to my room. I just, you know, out of compassion for other people, even though it was a hard thing to let go of, I just flushed the toilet. And this incredibly beautiful piece of art just went down the loo. But that's actually what happens. And if you can see such beauty, you know, in a sort of a piece of shit, I mean, what else can you not see? Actually, it was one of the questions last week was very interesting. Because on the question time, somebody wrote, you said we were all beautiful meditators, but you also said shit was beautiful. What can I understand by that? And that's what happens when you're mindful. Anyway, so mindfulness is this great like opening and awakening of the mind. So actually you can stare at a clump of bamboo for hours and hours. And you can see so much more in it than you've normally seen. If you want to see the Dhamma, understand the truth of things, you need that degree of mindfulness. Strong, powerful. And you can tell that you've got that type of mindfulness when you start to see beauty everywhere. And when that sort of captivates you. And when you have that degree of mindfulness, of course it's just such an easy thing to watch the breath. You start watching the breath, and wow, this breath is amazing, it's beautiful, it's amazing what you can see happening there. Or you can do your walking meditation. And you're lifting a foot, incredible just the amount of muscles which are moving, just for one foot to move up an inch. And you can feel all of that. And it's delightful, it's full, there's so much going on there. Restlessness just cannot exist. There's just too much to go on. You can't sort of think about something, it's just too much happening. And it's all very delightful. So sloth and torpor again can't happen. Again, I remember from my youth, I was travelling in Central America and getting a boat ride up the Caribbean coast, and it left, you know, this was the only way you could travel in those days, 69 it was. And you had to leave just after midnight, about 1 a.m. So I didn't sleep, managed to get to the boat, and of course, you know, the sun came up, the morning sun over the Caribbean. And that was incredibly beautiful. And even though I hadn't slept all night and I was just dog tired, no way could I go to sleep. It was just too beautiful, the sunrise. And I noticed from that, whenever there's a lot of happiness and joy, you just don't get tired. Joy and happiness is one of the great ways of overcoming sloth and torpor. If you're having a good time and have lots of joy, you just don't need to sleep, you don't want to sleep, you can't sleep. It's just too enjoyable. You get depressed having a bad time, of course you get very sleepy. So, the joy, the energy, that kept the mindfulness very strong. So this is what we mean by mindfulness. This is what you develop. The ability, through letting go, through being still, it happens naturally, you don't have to force it. Just stop, restrain, let go, and your mindfulness increases, and everything gets beautiful, delightful, and you see much deeper into things. And hopefully you'll experience that on this retreat. Food tastes better, trees are more beautiful, and be careful of your toilet bowl. If you see someone sitting in the toilet for hours and hours, it's not they're constipated, they're just contemplating the most beautiful thing they've ever seen. That's why we have our own personal toilets, so you know you can do that without causing trouble to others. So then you've got Dhamma Vicaya, investigating Dhammas, and you can see just how it happens as a natural result of mindfulness. When it's very strong and bright, it has an inquisitive nature to it. You look and say, that clump of bamboo, wow! And it just, the joy, the happiness and the power just draws you into the object. And you see more deeply into it than you've ever seen before. Dhamma Vicaya, this investigating the Dhamma, is not thinking about it. So, what am I going to hold up this time? Here we go. So, the exercise is this. I hold something up and I ask you, what is this? Kleenex box. Yes, thank you for starting us off. What else is it? Tissue box, yeah. Anything else? Describe it to me. Container, yes, what else? Yes, what else? Cardboard. Is that Dhamma Vichaya? Or is that thinking? Now you keep on going until you run out of names. Once you run out of names, that's when contemplation begins. You start to see it beyond all the labels of what it is, or what you were told it is. There's a problem of human beings. Because of our educations, we just contemplate things through labels, through words. So we never see things as they truly are. So when you're mindful, yeah, it's a box, it's tissues, it's grey, it's got, I don't know what was supposed to be on top of it, what colours or what painting it is, but it doesn't matter. You say that, push it aside and keep on looking. And that becomes Dhamma Vichaya. To be able to see things without giving anything a name. The classic teaching which I give in meditation classes, to get to that degree of silence where you can really see things, is that story of Lao Tzu. He would go on a walk with a disciple every evening, but there was a golden rule. You had to remain silent. You couldn't go talk on a walk with a master. And of course, sooner or later, this young guy went along with a walk with a great master. They came to a ridge in the mountains. It was sunset. And the new student said, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He broken the golden rule. And Lao Tzu just turned around. And he went back to the monastery. And he would never allow that young man to go on a walk with the master ever again. And when this young man's friends interceded, said, "Don't be so tough. He only said, what a beautiful sunset, what's wrong with that?" And then Lao Tzu told the students, when that boy said, "What a beautiful sunset," he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words. When I read that, light bulbs came on in my head. How much, when we live in a world of concepts and words, we miss the real thing. If you say, "What a beautiful sunset," you've lost the sunset. You're just watching the words. If you say, "Tissue box," you're not looking at this anymore. You're just looking at the words. So for Dhamma Vichaya, we need to be able to see something in silence, as if we're looking at it for the very, very first time. Not with all the way you've been taught to see things before, but with a clear, peaceful mind. It is from such understandings that one of my favorite sayings is, never let your learning stand in the way of truth. Never let knowledge stand in the way of truth. Because knowledge is tissue box. It's cardboard. This is your knowledge. It's not the truth. When you push aside all those words, then perhaps you can see things. That is Dhamma Vichaya. All coming from that incredibly strong mindfulness, which is silent. And then, from that great silence, to being able to investigate in mindfulness, we get energized. We get this incredible energy from meditation. I don't know about you, but I've been very busy this last week because I've been back-to-back retreats, and this last 5 days has squashed all this work in for me. So I have a standard amount of work which I have to do, funerals, blessings, messing around, administration. And when you do retreats, all that work which I should be doing just at leisure all gets squashed into just the spaces in between. So I was very, very busy. So I'm a bit tired, but I know, as this week goes on, when your mindfulness starts to increase, your energy levels increase also. Your back becomes straight. Your eyes begin to bulge. Your smile becomes greater as your energy increases. And there are some times, I hope, for you here, that some of you get so energized after the Q&A in the evening, you just know where you can go back to bed. is sit up here. 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, you're not at all tired. You're buzzing. You're energized. 1, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, you're still going strong. You just don't sleep. Nothing wrong with that. You've got energy. That happens naturally. You cannot force it. If you force it, it gets this very dangerous, tense type of energy. This is the natural just energy which comes when the mind is very bright and energized. It doesn't waste energy because it's not thinking and doing and planning and complaining. You can imagine just how much energy you waste with thinking and complaining and planning and remembering, planning things which will never happen, complaining about things which you can never change. It's amazing just how inefficient we are. And after a while, you begin to get mindful, investigate dhammas in silence, and energy just comes. You literally are waking up again. That's why the word Buddha. There's people who have been pointing out to me that it's not right to call it the enlightened one. It misses out some of the meaning of the Pali Sanskrit word. It means the awakened one. It comes from the verb bujjhati, which means to wake up. And when you look at the Buddha like the awakened one, you can see why this energy, this mindfulness is actually awakening your mind. You realize that most of the time it's dull, it's living in a dream, in sort of in low energy states. But when you do these meditation retreats, you get high energy states, really strong virya. And you are waking up, you've got energy, it's bright. And of course, I've been meditating a long time. I use that to be able to perform. Sometimes you may look at the schedule when I sort of go overseas and go talking and doing all this sort of stuff. And, sometimes, how on earth could you do that? 14, 15, 16 hours a day sometimes. And sometimes I look at it and go, I can't do that. But you have your ways of doing it. I remember on this one occasion, I flew all the way, that's on a Saturday morning, I give talks on Friday night. And after the talk, people are lining up with all their problems, talking to me. So don't go to sleep till late and wake up early, because my nature is to get up early in the morning. I just can't help myself. I did set my alarm clock for 4 o'clock, 3:30, I was awake and up and out. I can't stop getting up early. So, you get up early, so you haven't had enough sleep. And on the plane to go to Singapore. And they're having this concert. It was a concert, a Dharma concert. And I was supposed to be the surprise star. At a certain time, the couple of people, the play was, that she was very upset at her father who was cheated on his wife, had a mistress, and I was eating her up for many years. She just hated her father, but she came across a book which changed her whole life, and which allowed her to forgive the infidelity of her father and the way she treated her mother. And what was that book? It was Opening the Door of Your Heart by Ajahn Brahm. Oh, I'd really like to meet that monk, said in the play. Really? Here he is. And that was my cue to come on. It wasn't actually like Broadway standard or even TV standard, but it worked. So I came on and gave a little talk. So that was my role in the play. So, okay. So the first performance, you managed to do that. But then afterwards, I was wiped out. I was really tired. Everyone else went off to have their dinner. And there you were, just really, really wiped out and exhausted. And you had another performance later on. All these people came and they're expecting you to do something. So what I managed to do in that theatre, I was looking for a quiet place. And there was one exit door which was actually closed, which no one could use. And so I could actually hide in there. It was like a little cave. It was brilliant. Just half an hour, while everyone else was having something to eat, I just disappeared. And just, you start off really sort of dull. But you're still, you don't fight. You just let things be. You're silent. You just allow the nature to happen. It's only half an hour. It's amazing what happens. Just you're really, really dull, worn out, drained. The energy starts to come back. Only about a quarter of an hour. And then you really get bright. And then you really get into it. And so after half an hour, you come out and people think you've taken some drugs. That's what it feels like, you know, that's what people think. It's not drugs, it's just the energy of stillness. That's what virya is, that type of energy. And when you know it, you can actually get into it any time, and that's beautiful energy. And of course, from that energy, you know, comes piti, comes this joy. The reason why many people are depressed is because they've got no energy left. You know, they've just been using it all up, arguing, controlling, struggling. And sometimes life is such a struggle. You know, other people are just so stupid. Why can't other people see the stupid? I've been fighting them, telling them, you're the stupid one. Other people are other people. One of our Jan Shah stories was, once there was a farmer who had a chicken, and he wanted it to be a duck. And he suffered all his life as a result. A very simple story, but that's actually very profound. If you've got a chicken and want it to be a duck, you're going to waste a lot of energy. You're going to get angry. You're going to fight a battle you never will win. No matter how many years you take your chicken and teach it to go quack quack, it will not go quack quack. It's a chicken, okay? So it's a complete waste of time. Just in the same way that somebody got married to a nice guy and wanted it to be a perfect guy. That's like getting like a chicken and wanted to be a duck. You're wasting your time. Or you get yourself and wanted you to be something like the Buddha. You know, you're not the Buddha. So you can't make a duck out of a chicken, okay? So, a lot of times just the pity is when we stop fighting things. We stop making every chicken to be ducks. We stop trying to make people be silent. The only people who are silent, the only people who don't make noise are dead people. So if you're living in a hut with dead people in the other five rooms, yes, it will be silent. If they're alive, they will make noise. Okay, so get used to it. That way is we're not actually fighting battles which we can't win, which means that we can have joy and happiness. We don't waste our energies. And that happiness, that joy, that comes as a result of energy. The two go together. All comes from just being still and being peaceful. And that's, you find that in this retreat. The energy comes and you're happier. And joy is such an important part of the meditation practice and the path towards enlightenment that as a teacher I use that as the indicator, as the gauge. Just like on the car, you know, whether you're running on empty or whether you've got a full tank. A little indicator on the dashboard. And you've got an indicator on your dashboard, it's called your mouth. If your meditation's going well, the indicator is the ends are turned up quite a lot. If you're running on empty and about to leave, they're right down here somewhere. And just having a horizontal mouth, I'm afraid that's not good enough. Because when you really get into the meditation, you can't help yourself but have happiness and smiling. It's the piti, the joy which comes up. And so number one, piti and joy is one of the enlightenment factors. It's part of the path into enlightenment. It's what you see in enlightened beings. They've got a natural joy to them. So, number one, develop joy. When it comes up, don't be afraid of it. When it's there for long periods of time, don't be scared. I'm going to get attached to joy. You are supposed to get attached to the joy. In a Pasadika Sutta. Actually, I gave the book to someone this morning. Pasadika Sutta Nidhika Nikaya. One of my favorite quotes of the Buddha. He said, if other religions say you monks are just attached to pleasure, you're having a good time. It actually gives you an indication of what monks were like in that time. Even then, people thought, oh, you guys are just enjoying yourself too much. You can't be real ascetics, not real monks. And he said, you should ask those other religions, what type of pleasure do you mean? Because if it's sensual pleasure, no. The monks are not attached to that. If it's the pleasures of the mind, yes, we are. We are attached to the pleasures of the mind. And if they say, well, what's going to happen if you're attached to the pleasures of the mind, especially if you're attached to the pleasures of jhana? And the Buddha replied, if you're attached to the pleasure of jhana, you can expect only one of four consequences. This is what happens if you're attached to the jhanas. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's the only four things which will happen to you if you get attached to the jhanas. Pasadika Sutta. So, it's a pretty good thing to be attached to, isn't it? Because that's what we're supposed to be doing, getting enlightened. So, the attachment to those pleasures is actually conducive to enlightenment. Pity, joy, is part of the path. It happens. When it happens, it's a sign that your meditation is going well. Don't get afraid. Don't throw it away thinking there must be something wrong. This is not Puritan Christianity. Somebody actually defined Puritanism as the fear that somewhere someone is happy. It's a great quote. Puritanism. The fear that someone somewhere is happy. That's bad. And actually our Western culture has been very heavily influenced by that. We're so afraid of happiness. We get sort of guilty that we're happy when there's so much suffering in the world. So look, you know, other people are suffering, they want you to be happy. You want them to be happy. If we're all miserable, that doesn't help anybody. So if you're happy, wonderful. And of course happiness is contagious. If you're happy, everyone else becomes happy around you. So happiness is a very compassionate thing to develop. As I often say, remember, if you're happy, imagine what that does to all the people who have to put up with you. There are many people in your workplace, in your life, which have to endure you. And if you're happy, you're a much better person to live with than some misery, sour puss, angry, depressed individual. So develop happiness as your compassionate gift to all the people you live with. So happiness, joy is important. And from that joy, from that happiness, then you do get tranquility. Now that's an important point from this enlightenment factors. You don't get tranquility through effort. Through trying. If you try and hold your body, yeah, you can do that, but that's not tranquility. That's control. That's freaky. When you're very joyful and happy, you sit here, oh, this is nice, oh, this is wonderful, oh, yeah, give me more. And your body becomes perfectly still when it's happy. When it's not happy, there's always some movement. That's why you can see people who stand, people who sit still with a smile on their face, they've got tranquility. People who are sitting still, gritting their teeth, that's not tranquility at all. And it's like the calming of the body and the mind. And you get into those states in meditation, I hope. You say, you know, you're watching the breath, say, and the breath becomes very delightful. That delightful or beautiful breath, that's a sign that pity's come up. And you're having such a wonderful time, you just actually forget your body. It's there, but it's doing its own thing. And that's why people can sit still for hours. Then they've got no awareness of their body because their awareness is on the beautiful, delightful breath. And the body looks after itself. It's a wonderful thing to be able to sit there for such a long time. Well, I had to learn that as a young monk. So some of those experiences I had. Oh, I told about the mosquito experience. This was another experience. I've been travelling all day, you know, on one of these buses in the north of Thailand. Cramped. Squashed. You know, and so it was incredibly uncomfortable for hour after hour after hour. And finally got to the destination. And I was tired, and the bus was stuffy. No air conditioners in those days, and really hard seats. So I was sore all over, just sweating. I just needed a drink and a shower. And I got to this monastery and said, oh, welcome. You're just in time. In about 20 minutes time, we're going to start our evening meditation for 4 hours. So every evening in this temple, they did a 4-hour sit. And you couldn't move, you had to sit. I thought, oh my God, how can I do this? I'm just so tired, I just arrived, and I'm really thirsty, so I very quickly had a shower, and got in there, no tea or coffee, and this was Thailand, this was many years ago, got there, and realised, look, you've got to sit for 4 hours, you better get into this meditation quickly, or you're going to suffer, Ajahn Brahm. So, you know, now I had to meditate, so you really got there, into a nice meditation, got some joy up, and the joy came up before the body started to hurt. So that was great, my body just disappeared. And just they rang the bell and I came out of my meditation. And I really scolded them. It's 1/4 hour early, it's only 3 hours and 45 minutes, you scallywags. We did that because you can do that. When you get the joy up, your body becomes very still and peaceful. It doesn't matter what you've been doing all day. You just don't get any aches and pains or hurt or whatever. So this is what happens. From that joy comes this beautiful tranquility of the body. Get the joy up first of all. The tranquility will come afterwards. And of course, once the body becomes absolutely still, no aches, no pains, no itches. For those of you who've got stomach aches, other aches, nose aches. I always have a nose ache because it's the hay fever season. Or coughs. Or aches somewhere or other. You know, many of you are getting on in years, and so you get more and more aches, more and more stiff joints and stuff. So, for those of you who have all this aches and stiffness, imagine your body just disappears, totally tranquilized. At last, you're free. You can just look after your mind. And it makes it so easy to meditate, when you can just drop this body. And because of that tranquility, Samadhi, the stillness of the mind, is so easy. Body is still, first of all, then your mind becomes still. You get incredible stillness states of mind. To have a still mind is not thinking. Thinking is not being still, that's being agitated. Stillness is not going off into the future or the past, that's agitation. Stillness is not expecting something to happen, looking into the future and anticipating something. That's agitation. Stillness means the mind is perfectly poised in this present moment. Not moving at all. Getting more and more still. And that stillness takes you into the incredibly powerful deep meditations. Where you're so still, you can't believe that anything could be so still. You've never experienced such deep states of peacefulness ever before. And they're blissful too. Things are stopping. Just the wheel of your life always been churning, always rolling, begins to slow down and stop. Wow, that's freaky. For many of you, you'll be scared. Ah, I'm not used to this. Ah, what's going to happen? I'll tell you what's going to happen. You're going to get enlightened. You're going, baby. You're going. That's wonderful. That's what we're supposed to do. Bye-bye, world. Bye-bye, birth. Bye-bye, suffering. You're getting still. But for many of you, it's such unfamiliar territory. That's why we get scared. That's why I have to keep talking about this. It is all right. It is what you're supposed to do. This is happening, and don't think, I've got to do Vipassana now. Let's think. No, don't think. If you want to contemplate, you've got to be still. Just wait, look, gather the data. You can think later. When your mind is still, leave it alone. And allow stillness to grow and develop. And that becomes the enlightenment factor. The stillness of samadhi. It is the jhanas. We'll talk about that later on in more depth. And because of the stillness, it means that the hindrances, which is basically wanting to do something or wanting to avoid something, all that defilements have totally disappeared. So now you can look upon something with no vested interest in what you're going to find. Your mind truly is open to see the truth. The reason why people will not see the Dhamma is because they don't want to. It's too scary. It challenges you far too much. I don't want to give up my sex. I don't want to give up my TV or my footy. I don't want to give up my children. So it's scary what you have to give up. I don't want to give up my body. It's amazing, just even if you're old and sick and in pain, people still are afraid to die. I can't understand that. Look, you know, you're getting old. You've got this old wreck of a body. Why not hand it in and get another one if you want another one? Instead of, but people, they're on their deathbed, being with them, on their deathbed, struggling. They're so afraid of dying. Even recently, you know that those of you in Perth here, I got myself involved in the euthanasia debate. And what came out of that for me was just how people are so afraid of dying, it is a taboo. Anything but keep you alive. If you've got no quality of life, even if you're just using up all the resources of a hospital so no other people can actually get sort of, you know, you can actually help and give up some quality of life to. No, no, we've got to keep you alive. Because the worst thing we can do is let you die. And doctors are so afraid of letting somebody die. And that, to the point is that the Australian Medical Association, no, we don't agree with euthanasia. But, you know, personally, if you ask them personally, yeah, well, actually, if it was me, please do it. Because it's a fear of death. So a fear of letting go of our body. And that's a ridiculous thing to have. So, because we live in a culture of the fear of death, actually I tell doctors, your job is not to keep people alive. Your job is not to cure illnesses. The job of a doctor is to care for their patients. Not to cure them, to care. Cure is your second job. Caring is your primary job. If cure happens, great. If they die, great, because they've been cared for. Care is number one. So anyway, so it is quite scary sometimes. Which is why that if you have all these enlightenment factors, you can look upon, say, your body with equanimity. Just look on, not interfere with the process. Die, die. Live, live. Without any fear. But that's an easy one, to let go of your body. Now, let go of your will. Can you do that? I told you to do that all the last couple of days. Let go. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. But no, no, you want to control it this way, that way, that way. It's so hard to let go, isn't it? What are we letting go of? Our will. And that's the thing which we just don't know, want to give up. Yeah, we can let go of our body, but we always want to be in control. Only arahats aren't control freaks. Everyone else is. And some of you are big control freaks. The more you control, the more suffering you're going to have. Haven't you got the message yet? The more control you are not hurting other people, you're just hurting yourselves. So just let go, for goodness sake, and enjoy this retreat. Stop controlling it. Just say, mind, it's up to you now. I'm on holiday. I'm not going to do anything for the next 9 days. Get jhanas, don't get jhanas, who cares? I'm on holiday, this is my vacation. I'm here to enjoy myself. Have a great time. No control. Ajahn Brahm doesn't control me, I won't control me. Absolutely no control. Total freedom. That's the most scary thing in the whole world. It is very much like that sort of simile of the person who's been in prison for... How old are you now? You've been in prison all that time. And now I fling open the doors and say, come on, come out. No, 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 I don't want to go. I'm very happy in my prison, thank you. Get away, Ajahn Brahm. And that's what it's like, because you've been in the prison of your will for such a long time. The very idea of just walking out is just too scary. But don't worry, it will happen. You know why it happens? Because of the joy. It's just too joyful, just too much fun. Outside, you can see. Yeah, I'm really afraid of going out of my prison cell, but it looks pretty good out there. No, I can't. But you know, it's nice. Okay. And you go for it eventually. You think, well, what was I so afraid of? Letting go of my will and just letting go, because it's so peaceful and so happy. And you're not having this tyrant tell you what to do all the time. You know what I mean? This will inside of you. It's like a monster between your ears, always ordering you around, telling you what to do, telling you you're not good enough, telling you try harder, telling you don't waste your time, telling you, look, I'm getting old, how many more times can I get on the retreat in Jhana Grove? I've got to try hard. That is will, that is enemy number one. So don't listen to that. Just let go. And just flow with nature. And if you can do that, you know what I mean by upeka. Just looking on, not interfering, not doing anything. And the last thing you have to let go of is your mind. As I said earlier, you've come here to lose your mind. It wasn't yours anyway, so you've got nothing to lose. You came here with nothing, and you will leave with nothing. What a beautiful thing that is. So, this is what the enlightenment factors are. The seven enlightenment factors, they do progress one after the other. And they do lead to enlightenment, and they are the essence of enlightenment. I've explained them to you in a way I hope you haven't heard them before. That's when you're paying attention. And also gives you some interesting, what I call brainwashing. For the next 7 days. I always brainwash people just when they've been meditating a lot, because then their minds are very amenable to brainwashing. And especially when you've eaten a nice breakfast, that's also very good psychology, because you lose your guard, because everything is nice and happy and satisfying, and that's when you can actually push the brainwashing in. So thank you for being amenable to this morning's brainwashing. You are totally conditioned, the message is in, so you're going to have a happy time and you're going to let go. And it happens, you wonder, what am I doing this for? And if you really look back and say, I know why I do this and speak like this and act like this, because that monk told me to. And you do it. So that way you can have a wonderful time. The seven enlightenment factors, bliss upon bliss, peace upon peace, stillness upon stillness, with everything just disappearing. And will, bye-bye will. You can have a nice free time instead of being under the sadistic guard called will. Okay, that's the talk today. Any questions? Yes. They are sequential when they... there's a sequential aspect to them. There's also an insequential one. Because you know Westerners, if there is a sequence, they'd always do it backwards. Because we're rebels, and be a rebel. I'm a rebel. All good religions are rebellious. That's why I always get into trouble. You're not really a religious leader until you've been expelled from somewhere and a heretic. So anyway, so you know, you follow my footsteps. Whatever works, use it. Okay. Okay, so have a happy morning. Again, I apologize, I won't be here for the morning interviews. But you don't need them, you've got a really good talk, that's good enough. So meditate, and all your questions will be answered on the meditation cushion or on the walking paths. And I'll see you for this afternoon's question and answer time. Have a great morning.